From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Never again. Those words, after the horrors of World War II, were meant to guide a new world order, one where differences among nations would be settled diplomatically without resorting to mass killing. And in Europe, that more or less held for decades, until February 24th, when Russia launched a full-scale ground invasion of Ukraine. Arguably, that conflict had been ongoing for the better part of a decade, but not at the scale of violence we've seen in the past 2 months. Yesterday, General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told CNN that what's been happening is the greatest threat to Europe since the Second World War, and in fact is not just a threat to Europe, but to the entire international order. Also yesterday, the UN Secretary General met with top Russian officials to discuss humanitarian corridors. But in a television broadcast, Russian President Vladimir Putin continued denying the reality of what his military has been doing. Meanwhile, the Russian National Gas Company cut off Poland and Bulgaria for refusing to pay in rubles, widely seen as a warning to other European countries over sanctions. Early in the war, we spoke with Ian Kelly, currently ambassador in residence at Northwestern University. He has deep experience in the region, having begun his career in the years of the Soviet Union. He later worked with NATO and was director of the Office of Russian Affairs in Washington. And President Obama named him ambassador to Georgia. A lot has changed in the 2 months since Russia first invaded Ukraine, and so we wanted to check in again. So, Ambassador Kelly, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Well, thanks for having me, Brian.
So I want to begin, and not to put you on the spot, but as a learning opportunity, what did you get wrong about how the conflict would go? We're hearing a lot of reassessment these days.
Well, I think a lot of us really overestimated the ability of the Russian military to be able to carry out those very ambitious aims that Putin first gave to it, and of course that was the decapitation of the Ukrainian government and presumably replacing it with a pro-Russian government, and then what he called the demilitarization of the Ukrainian armed forces. I think, you know, in the first instance, it was a pretty spectacular failure, and the Russian forces that were tasked with surrounding Kyiv, the capital, and forcing such a change of regime were basically whacked by the Ukrainian forces and were forced to withdraw. And so now Kyiv is no longer under threat. In terms of demilitarizing or destroying the Ukrainian armed forces, he's failed on that too. The Ukrainian armed forces have done an extraordinary job at repelling Russia from its attack on Kyiv, and just has been able to really restrain Putin from taking over what he says now is his war aim, and that's taking over the Donbas region, the eastern part of Ukraine. You know, having said all that, it's still a very, very dangerous situation and a tragedy for the Ukrainian people. And this war is unfortunately far from over.
Yeah, and we can talk a little bit more about Putin's strategic aims and how this conflict might continue to play out and hopefully come to an end sooner than later. But I wonder, where do you get your news on Ukraine? What sources are you relying on? It strikes me that there's a lot of armchair intelligence analysis that's happening in this conflict that I don't remember from other recent conflicts around the world, in part because you have this sort of real-time or seemingly real-time flow of images on Twitter and other social media. How are you staying informed?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I have kind of a two-pronged approach, I think, to trying to follow this war. One is I follow a number of really good military analysts on Twitter. Probably the best is an analyst named Michael Kaufman, K-O-F-M-A-N, and they follow very carefully the disposition of Russian forces and Ukrainian forces, the kind of weapons they're using. And that's very, very useful. The other part of this I follow is just kind of the policy part of it. The policy of the Biden administration. But then I also, and this is not an easy thing to do, I also follow some of the talk shows on Russian TV, on Russian state TV, which are really a good indication of the very toxic narrative that that the Putin regime is putting out about the war. It is really, kind of the bizarro world view on what's happening. It's a war of liberation. They're trying to protect Russian speakers from genocide. It's also a proxy war against the West and its attempts to subjugate Ukraine and make it a kind of a forward operating base to destroy Russia. And as I say, it's not easy watching this kind of stuff. You get some real howlers of lies on Russian TV these days.
Yeah, and certainly not something that's available to most of us who don't speak Russian. But so that's the state-distributed propaganda and what the Russian people are seeing. There's also been some talk that maybe Putin isn't getting a full picture from his military advisors. Do you have a sense of that, or is there any truth to that?
Well, this is the real weakness, I think, of authoritarian regimes. The leader tends to be surrounded by a small group of, I guess, advisors or a small cabal around him, and because of the power of the dictator, they are not inclined to tell him the truth. They're afraid to tell him the truth. And also, it is not career enhancing for them to tell Vladimir Putin what the actual situation is. So I fear that he's somebody who doesn't follow Twitter. He doesn't look for sources of information on the internet. And so he relies pretty much on his security services to provide him a picture of what's going on. And that, I think, really is one of the main reasons why the initial phase of this war was such a spectacular failure. He really did believe that the Ukrainian government would fall apart. That's what his advisors told him. That within a week they could take Kyiv, and of course it didn't happen because the Ukrainians do not want to be a part of Putin's world. They want to be aligned with Europe and not with Putin's authoritarian regime.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Ambassador Ian Kelly, former ambassador to the Republic of Georgia under the Obama administration. He's been a State Department spokesperson, representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And today he's ambassador in residence at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. We are more than 2 months into the Russian invasion of Ukraine now. The conflict has gone a lot differently than people were predicting in the earliest days of the war. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation, or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21ST Show. I wonder, what do you make of we've seen these horrible, horrible acts of violence against the civilian population in Ukraine, which, I mean, on one level, that says something about the Russian military and maybe a lack of discipline there and the way the war is going from the sort of grunt perspective. But what does that say about this conflict to you?
Yeah, well, of course, I think that has been really the most appalling aspect of this. These evidence of these terrible massacres in areas that Russia occupied for a few weeks around Kyiv in the north of the country, and I think that there are a couple of explanations for it. I think there's a lack of command and control. You know, from following these military analysts, I've seen explanations that there is very little control by non-commissioned officers of Russian troops, and you know, allow these troops to run amok, basically. There's also, I think, the failure of the leadership to send a message that it's inappropriate to target civilians. I mean, if you look at how they have conducted artillery bombardments, how they've used their cruise missiles. And this is the same thing they did in Syria. It's pretty indiscriminate, and you see a kind of a scorched earth approach to trying to take a city, and that just implies that everybody's fair game. And then I would also blame the leadership for the kind of rhetoric they've had, calling the Ukrainian government Nazis. Just basically suggesting the country does not exist, that it's anti-Russian, and that anybody, of course, who supports Ukraine is an enemy and fair game. So it's, as I say, this is the most, I think, distressing part of this conflict, the use of, the targeting of civilians. And I fear it's a war aim, in the sense that they feel that they can use this kind of technique to terrorize the population, put pressure on the Ukrainian government to negotiate a solution. And of course, it's not working. The Ukrainian people have, I think, rallied around the government rather than put pressure on it.
A lot of people have said they want to see Putin held accountable. President Biden called for him to be tried for war crimes. I wonder, is there any possibility of that? I think of the number of heads of state who have actually been tried for war crimes is a pretty short list, and an even shorter list when you think of people who have had that experience without, you know, a foreign invasion. Thinking of Saddam Hussein, for example. So you know, is this even something that's a real possibility?
Well, not as long as Vladimir Putin's in control, you know, or his cabal is in control. It's basically unlikely, as you say, without military intervention, that he would ever be sent to The Hague for a war crimes tribunal. on the one hand, I think it sends a signal to the Russian people that they are isolated, that all of Europe, essentially, and North America, and G7 nations like Japan, see their leader as a pariah, and worthy of being charged with war crimes. On the other hand, you know, there's another side to this where it could have the effect of rallying. You know, rallying people around their beleaguered leader. So, yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword, you know, accusing the president of war crimes.
And it seems like the mass public, though, as we said earlier, in Russia, just has no concept of what the rest of the world is thinking about this, unless you're going through a lot of steps to try and get around firewalls and get access to outside information.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And there is a correlation between those who use the internet to get alternative sources of information and the level of popularity of Putin, those who just rely on television, the level of support is pretty high, obviously. And it's tough to really get a good gauge on support because you can't really trust public opinion polls. If you're a Russian and a stranger calls you and said, do you support President Putin? It's not very likely you're going to say no to this stranger. So that's why it's hard to judge what the level of support is.
Yeah, that's a pretty easy multiple choice test, I guess. All right, so we need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation with Ambassador Ian Kelly. When we come back, we're going to talk about the role of the United Nations, what the Russian invasion of Ukraine has to say about the international order set up in the wake of World War II that was supposed to help keep the peace, help nations solve their disputes diplomatically, not through war. That's going to continue after a short break. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Ambassador Ian Kelly, who began his career in the State Department during the last days of the Soviet Union. He was part of the American diplomatic crew reestablishing American embassies throughout the former Soviet republics in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Today, he's ambassador in residence at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. 800-222-9455. Ambassador Kelly, what does this conflict say about the United Nations, which, as I mentioned earlier, never again, it was expressly created to sort of prevent these kind of conflicts. Do we need to be thinking about a new kind of international organization?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of people have pondered the answer to this question. Of course, the problem with the UN Security Council, which in the vision of Franklin Roosevelt and others was supposed to adjudicate these disputes before they became armed conflicts, and of course, the problem is that five of the permanent members have a veto. One of those permanent members is Russia. So clearly, Russia, under Putin anyway, is going to veto anything that is perceived as trying to stop Russia's aggression. Where the UN serves a real function, I think, is in humanitarian aid. The UN has a refugee agency. It has the World Food Program is part of it. And there is a real crying need right now for a humanitarian corridor coming out of Mariupol, which is surrounded by Russian troops, and Russians have refused to set up such a corridor. If they do agree, they end up firing on the vehicles coming out of Mariupol. So if the UN Secretary General can help evacuate those hundreds of innocent civilians, that would be a wonderful thing.
So the American diplomats made their first, top-level diplomats at least, made their first appearance in Ukraine recently on Sunday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his top cabinet officials. Can you talk about the significance of that and some of the things they're saying, right? I was struck that Secretary Austin mentioned that he wants to see the Russian military capabilities significantly degraded. Those are pretty strong words, at least it strikes me. How does it strike you?
Exactly the same way. It was. I think a lot of people, their ears perked up when they heard him say that our aim is to weaken Russia's ability to conduct military operations. That is a new angle. the previous explanation for our policy was to support Ukraine and defend its sovereignty, which still goes on. But yeah, this idea that we are going to try and degrade Russia's military and also their economy to not enable them to conduct further operations like this. This is, that's basically saying this is a proxy war. And I was a bit surprised by it. Sure. Obviously, I support that idea, but it was a departure.
Should that make us more nervous? I mean, there are a lot of Americans who have a pretty, you say proxy war, and, you know, pick your past historical example of, you know, quagmires and things escalating. And, you know, I know American military personnel are not implicated in the conflict at this point. Is that, you know, how worried should we be about this really escalating?
Well, I think a lot depends on the reaction of the Kremlin. I think that this kind of statement, you know, obviously is going to give them pause as well. And it depends on what kind of stake Putin has in the ultimate success of this war. And if we are so bent on preventing him from reaching these war aims, you know, how far is Putin willing to go to stop us in our aims? I think as long as we do not have U.S. troops involved, I am not really afraid of the kind of nightmare escalation I think that everybody has on their minds right now. But still, it is a like I say, it depends on how Putin reacts to it.
Yeah, I know you have other obligations this morning, but I do want to ask if you have time for one more question. What you think are the most likely possibilities of how this ends? I mean, is there anything? I mean, we've had millions of refugees, thousands of deaths on both sides, right? Reportedly, thousands of Russian soldiers have been killed. Is there anything that either Russia or Ukraine can legitimately call a victory? How does this end?
Yeah, no, it's really hard to see how it ends, in part because of the amazing determination of Ukraine's leadership, you know, to ensure the continued independence and sovereignty of Ukraine. I mean, I would hope that eventually it ends in a ceasefire of some kind. It's hard for me to imagine that the Ukrainian leadership right now or the Ukrainian people would accept long-term occupation of big parts of Ukraine, particularly its ports on the Black Sea coast. I really do think it will end in a ceasefire. Unfortunately, it won't mean an end to a conflict, because I think that there will be increased efforts to try and push Russia back. This war can't be sustained for more, I think, than a few more months. But, you know, I don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah, of course not. Well, I hope that it's less than that, actually, as I'm sure you do as well. Ambassador Ian Kelly, Ambassador in Residence at Northwestern University, thank you for being with us again today on the 21st Show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.